Good afternoon and welcome to today's insight session on cyber risk from a reinsurer's perspective. We've all heard of cyber attacks, whether it be in the public or private sector, and it is definitely a risk to be addressed. In fact, in the past 2 weeks, two separate reports were released to increase cyber risk awareness. One being the threat report from the Australian Government's Australian Cyber Security Centre and the other from APRA to share its cybersecurity survey results. In cybersecurity, prevention is always better than a cure. Today, Mark will be sharing Munich Re's extensive experience in the global cyber market. He will be discussing the taxonomy of cybersecurity, the life cycle of an attack, a general risk management framework, and discussing cyber insurance. Mark has 40 years of experience in insurance, and has worked in the UK, Perth, Melbourne and Sydney markets. Mark is best known for his experience in casualty underwriting and is a portfolio specialist in areas including cyber. Please join me in welcoming Mark.
Thank you very much, Jennifer, and thank you very much for coming along today. Thank you, Jennifer, for the excellent introduction. That's probably saved the audience at least a minute. There is an awful lot to digest in today's presentation, and I know this is on a webinar, and I know the play recording is available afterwards, so if you lose track during the course of the presentation, obviously you'll be able to catch up on what's been said afterwards. So, as Jennifer's pointed out, she's quite rightly gone through the agenda, and we will be covering all of those things as mentioned by Jennifer, so we'll move straight into the presentation. So the security policy of any business is based on management's commitment to protecting the assets of the enterprise and also the information of its business partners from various threats, exposures and attacks that could occur. Now, assets, as you know, have both tangible and intangible value that are worth protecting. So assets commonly include information about individuals, customers, suppliers, employees, reputation, brand, cash and investments, financial data, research, marketing plans, HR data, and intellectual property, which are things like trademark, copyright, patents, and trade secrets. Now, according to Forrester's research in the US, the S&P market value, 88% of that value consists of goodwill and intangible assets, such as reputation, brand and customer experience, which emphasises the high value of digital assets today. Determining the importance of assets is usually done in the context of organisational activities. Calculating the value of an information system or data source is usually done on the basis of confidentiality, integrity and availability. Assets of the enterprise are highly attractive and susceptible to cyber criminals as there is a lucrative and secondary market for stolen money and information. So on the slide here you will see that basically big sums of money are paid for cyber criminals to find zero-day vulnerability exploits in the platform software and applications. And if I can give you a quick table here, you can see that the value of stolen personal information has obviously increased from 2012-2015. You can see some of the types of personal information that's very valuable. Obviously, bank access details and credit card information is in the top three. Now, as you would expect, vulnerability in business IT systems can expose digital assets to loss, denial of access and misconfiguration. A vulnerability refers to a weakness in the design, implementation, operation or the internal control of a process that could expose the system to adverse threats and threat events. The harsh reality is that almost all successful cyber attacks happen because either people have done something or have not done something, or because the process rather than the technology has failed. Driven by rapid advances in technology in our digitalised world, most businesses today interact over electronic networks or the internet, and in Australia that now has 21 million users, including mobile, and it was never designed to be secure, or they're now reliant on third-party technology vendors and suppliers like cloud service providers. In particular, it's no surprise then that the increased vulnerabilities arise from inadequate policies of those that apply to wireless access, outsourcing to IT and cloud providers, bringing your own device, use of social media, and policies which govern employees during times of merger and acquisition activity. Security has always lagged behind technologies and it produces a range of new exposures. There is, of course, an increasing trend for companies today using cloud services to enable their business. The result is that they no longer control the infrastructure that employees are using. For instance, to revoke a user's access to a file they manage, permissions are in Dropbox. And to prevent the same user from getting their email, they have to administer Gmail access. And using the cloud, of course, can introduce additional threats to organisational activity. In June 2014, an Australian company was put out of business when a cyber adversary used the company's legitimate cloud login to irretrievably delete company data from the cloud service provider. Digital assets are, of course, exposed to a huge range of cyber threats. A threat is anything that is capable of acting against an asset in a manner which obviously causes harm. So in 2015, 50% of all major Australian businesses had at least one cyber incident. The key threats were ransomware, malware, and targeted malicious emails. Malware is also called malicious code, is software which is designed to gain access to targeted computer systems, steal information, or disrupt computer operations. Ransomware is a specific type of malware. It's a class of extortive malware that locks up or encrypts data or functions and demands a payment to unlock them. Hands up whose smartphone's been locked down by a crypto locker? Anyone? Okay, wait till you have that experience. You'll then have to find a way to pay bitcoins to have the data released. Otherwise, your choice is you just lose your photos and all your personal information. Not a good thing to happen. The other main category of cyber attacks is social engineering, or any attempt to exploit social vulnerabilities to gain access to information and or systems, and involves con games that tricks the user into divulging information or opening malicious software. Here's a fact. 98% of all cybersecurity incidents start with an email. Phishing is the most common type of social engineering attack. It's usually seen as the links embedded in email messages. These scams lead potential victims into seemingly trustworthy web pages where they're prompted to provide their personal information, including email addresses and credit card numbers. They often appear to come from reputable sources, which makes the embedded link even more compelling to click on. Spear phishing attacks use techniques to masquerade as a trusted party, like a government agency, which urges you to complete a personal survey or pose by forced banking sites. Earlier this year, fraudulent Olympic-themed emails redirected potential victims to fake ticketing services where they would eventually input their personal and financial transactional information. So who are the actors or adversaries who actually conduct cyber threats, and what's their motivation? Well, there are many types of attackers in today's threat landscape, and these include hacktivists, which are politically motivated hackers who target specific individuals or organisations to achieve various ideological ends. There are cyber terrorists who frequently target critical infrastructure and government agencies. There are nation states that target government and private entities to obtain intelligence. So two examples here. Think about the new ASIO building in Canberra, where the plans were hacked, funny enough, from the building contractor's IT system. Or think of the Bureau of Meteorology, where they had a supercomputer hacked, which had links to six government agencies, including, funny enough, the Department of Defence. Notwithstanding, research actually shows that disgruntled or distracted employees are the firm's biggest threat. Experience shows that humans are usually the weakest link in any security system. Cybersecurity breaches are most commonly insider jobs. Current or former employees who either maliciously or inadvertently cause a loss of data, everything from a deliberate theft of sensitive information to losing laptops, opening infected emails, and using weak passwords. My big point, cybercrime is big business. It accounts for 72.4% of all motivation behind cyber attacks in August 2016, according to Hackmageddon. Okay, so we've heard about the web. Well, which part of the web are we going to look at? Well, let's look at all three. So the surface web we're probably all familiar with, which is the portion of the World Wide Web that is readily available to the general public and is searchable using standard search engines like Alphabet, Google and Bing. The deep web, or the internet, consists of web pages that aren't indexed by search engines and are inaccessible by web crawlers. So an example will be your online bank account page. That's part of the deep web. Those of you like me who've watched the second series of The Code on the ABC will know the dark web is a collection of thousands of websites that use anonymity tools like Tor and 12p to intentionally hide their IP address. While the dark web's famously been used for enabling lucrative e-commerce black market or stolen data from legitimate sources, black market drug users and even child pornography, the dark web also enables anonymous whistleblowing and protects users from surveillance and censorship. Now, you'll notice that most of the iceberg is submerged underwater and obviously hides a great mess. So the number of reported identities that have been exposed in data breaches are just the tip that you're seeing above the surface. So what do you think remains hidden? Well, according to Symantec's 2016 Security Threat Report, there were no fewer than 429 million known identities which were exposed in 2015. But of course, that number is far likely to be a lot higher as many companies actually choose not to reveal the true extent of any data breach that they've had. Okay, so now let's have a look at the life cycle of a cyber attack and what a compromise actually looks like. Now, one myth about cyber that really annoys me and really I wanted to dispel is that each cyber attack is different, hence prevention is impossible. The reality is that old successful tactics are being used again and again by criminals who reuse code and share it amongst themselves. In many instances, the cyber attack is essentially the same, no matter what kind of attack it is. Examples include, as you can see on the screen, the Mossack Fonseca or the Panama Papers and the Ashley Madison, which, of course, the breach there exposed only 37 million active users who are all looking for an affair. And both of these had one thing in common. The vulnerability here was called SQL injection. And this vulnerability, wait for it, was discovered first by Microsoft in 1999. Yep, it's still the cause of major security incidents today and highlights the issue around cybersecurity is less about technology and more about people and processes. In the case of Ashley Madison, the impact of the cyber attack is absolutely enormous. The website owners, which is Avid Dating Life and Avid Media, are now facing class actions totaling, wait for it, US $567 million. So as mentioned, the cyber attack process is the same each time. It can be illustrated best by the Lockheed Martin cyber attack process, which we call the cyber kill chain, which is a framework for the identification and prevention of cyber intrusions. In effect, there are certain steps that a hacker has to undertake in order for them to be successful. The starting point is reconnaissance and the attack concludes with exfiltration. Therefore, if you can stop hackers and break the chain at any one step, the cyber attack will be unsuccessful. So how does a cyber attack really look like? Okay, so the answer to that is basically going to be in the seven stages of the advanced threats connected to the or like a chain, such as Lockheed Martin cyber kill chain, and I'll break these down into each step and explain them for you. So stage one, this is called reconnaissance. Now, reconnaissance is the action of learning information about your target. This can be a company, person, group, and other people, and so on. If the goal was to learn about a specific individual, then you'd spend time learning about them, where they live, where they work, where they went to school, do they have any hobbies, etc. With social media today, this can be accomplished with little effort. Just think about the own personal information you put about yourself, which you've already posted on LinkedIn or Facebook. Stage two is about crafting the attack or the lure. Now that the attacker has a profile about the individual, they can create a lure specifically for them that will increase the chances of the person's engaging with the threat. Typically, this would be an email or banner ad on a web page about a local conference specific to the industry in which the individual works in. Stage three is about infiltration using techniques like the redirect. Now, redirects are all about taking the individual to a place where they never intended to go. So imagine this email is forwarding service for a letter that you've sent. You thought you've sent it to 1800 First Street, New York, but that address is actually set up to forward that mail to 1500 Second Street, Orlando in Florida, and that address is actually set up to forward the mail to 1200 Third Street, Dallas, Texas. You see, the first person meant to send it to 1800 First Street, New York, but ended up in Texas. Well, this is what redirects do with web pages. You mean to go to a specific site for a conference, but that site was set up to send you to another place that you never intended to go. Stage four is called the exploit kit, which is a tool that's used to find and take advantages of vulnerabilities to install a dropper file or malicious software that has a malicious intent. You see, an exploit kit is named well as it looks for vulnerabilities to exploit. When you're engaging in web surfing, your computer or device has to connect and communicate to another computer or server. To ensure that these two devices can communicate correctly, they have to introduce each other and give some information so that they can communicate. An example would be the computer server that hosts the web page you want to view needs to know what operating system you are using. What browser you use, is it Java enabled? Do you run Flash? Do you have auto-run and autoplay features? With this information, the computer server knows how to communicate to your device so you can view the web page successfully. However, with an exploit kit, it also collects this information and runs it against a list of known vulnerabilities that the operating system or browser may have. If it detects a known vulnerability, the exploit kit will then use that vulnerability to force you to install the malicious dropper file or software. Stage five is all about the dropper file. This is where the computer server uses the known vulnerability to deliver the dropper file. Now, all dropper files are different and they've got different purposes. Some are to take immediate action, while others might stay dormant for hours, days, or even years. The data to be extracted or compromised is identified in this stage. Stage six is about establishing a command or the call home. Now that the dropper file has infected the device, it will call home at some point. The call home is to a command and control server to get instructions. Sometimes it will download more malicious files for the attack, or it can just check to let the hacker know that you are compromised and the hacker will wait for their moment to use your device for an attack. The final stage is called exfiltration or data theft. And this is when the attacker uses the infected device to steal information. This can be, of course, be credit card numbers, embarrassing emails, company research and development, or anything else they want. And, of course, the last stage is the stuff we read about in the headlines, and for most, it's game over. So, talking about vulnerabilities, I'm reminded around banks, financial institutions, and I'm going to say this. Cyber resilience of banks is not all the same. $81 million was stolen recently from the Bank of Bangladesh, with plans to steal a further $900 million. The cyber attack was successfully exploited by exploiting the same vulnerability of, yep, you guessed it, SQL injection, which you'll remember was first publicised as a vulnerability back in 1999. And again, reinforcing the point that almost all cyber attacks happen either because people have done something, or in this case, have not done something, or because the process rather than the technology has failed. Right, let's switch over. Let's now take a high-level overview of the key functions of information security and risk management to protect digital assets. Cyber resilience. It's the ability to prepare for, respond to, and recover from a cyber attack. Resilience is more than just preventing or responding to an attack. It also takes into account the ability to adapt and recover from such an event. Cyber resilience is the intended outcome of cyber risk management and cyber security measures. Whilst there are a number of accredited international frameworks and standards for cyber security, the controls I'm going to elaborate on come from the US National Institute for Standards and Technology, or acronym for NIST. These are incorporated into Report 429, Cyber Resilience and Health Check, which has recently been produced by ASIC. Now, why is this important to you? Well, it's estimated that most organisations over the next 2 years that come under the jurisdiction and governance of ASIC are going to be subject to a review based on this framework. Now, we all need to accept that cyber attacks are a real threat. Whatever the size or industry of an attacked organisation, the threat and actor adversaries remain the same. Both will require the same amount of cybersecurity protection, and perhaps this is really the problem. So a survey by PwC of Australian CEOs found that 82% considered cybersecurity one of the top three threats to business growth, highlighting the increasing recognition of the problem amongst boards. It is clear that cybersecurity now has an increased focus from the regulators such as ASIC and the OAIC. In Australia, year on year, cybersecurity incidents are increasing by 34%, and make no mistake, this country is definitely a target. The growth in incidents is mainly coming from Tier 2 and 3 organisations that lack sufficient resources and are easily exploited by cyber criminals. Disturbing is the fact that on average 200 days elapses after a breach occurs before it's actually discovered. And 60% of all breaches are actually discovered by external people, such as the customer experiencing a data leak or some regulatory agency uncovering it and then reporting back to you. Pretty embarrassing. The reason why cyber threats will continue to grow, both in number and severity of impact, is due to both cultural shifts and advances in technology and our adoption of it. So culturally, we've resigned ourselves to believe that no system is truly secure. Given enough time and money, any system can be broken. All consumers now are having discussions on what data government is collecting and how companies are tracking consumers and selling the data to advertisers. Technology trends, of course, relate to the ever-increasing use of the cloud and, of course, the Internet of Things. Now, I'm just going to make this point to you. The outsourcing of data processing does not remove the liability of the outsourcing organisation to ensure proper data protection. Adding internet connectivity to essentially everything is going to create a much larger surface of attack for the average consumer who already connects using their laptops and smartphones. Security on devices connected to your network, such as speakers, light bulbs and refrigerators, all have poor securities. HP, in a recent study, found that each of these IoT devices had no fewer than 25 security flaws. So let's just have a quick look at the current cyber risk landscape in Australia, and I've put up some statistics here on the slide, and I'm just going to make some quick observations and trends. The first one's probably the worst. This one here, first one here. So Australia's now ranked third for malicious websites and phishing attacks and fourth globally for botnet infections. Just confirming it, yeah, our country is definitely a target. One of the horrible ones here that I don't like is this number here, which says that 60% of all small, medium enterprises close their doors within 6 months after a major cyber attack. As you'll appreciate and as you can expect, the threat landscape's increasing from increased levels of access and connectivity from cloud computing, social media and mobile computing. Time to have a look at the cybersecurity framework. The NIST cybersecurity framework allows businesses to access and manage your cyber resilience by assisting with determining your current cybersecurity capabilities, setting goals for a target level of cyber resilience, and to establish a plan to improve and maintain cybersecurity and resilience. So the NIST framework, which we're going to cover, has five domains, which are identify, protect, detect, respond, and recover. So we'll start with the identity function. Now this, of course, comes back to the visibility issue of how do you recognise cybersecurity risks and what you need to look out for within your organisation. What information or business assets are essential to your business? And in fact, an odd thing, having an asset inventory is really important. Where's the data located? What are the cyber risks, the threats and vulnerabilities that your business is exposed to? How many people know where the key information resides within the enterprise? And what is the cyber resilience and vital third-party providers and clients? The protect function deals with the controls and safeguards that are necessary to both protect and deter cybersecurity threats. The question of how you prepare revolves around the structure of the enterprise and the awareness and training given to staff. Now, remember I talked about spear phishing earlier on as being one of the major areas for cyber threats in Australia. Okay, so I'm going to give you a little bit of practical advice about how you might deal with reducing spear phishing threats in your organisation. So, for a really good defence for social engineering attacks like spear phishing, it's pretty important to ensure that all employees know what they are, know what they look like, and are critical of every email, pop-up ad, and embedded link that they encounter on the internet. This should be then reinforced by an HR policy advising employees that the organisation demands zero tolerance to cyber incidents resulting from employee negligence, and anyone found being careless will be investigated. So the how do you prevent question deals with the processes and procedures and testing of existing IT systems. Simple question, what are the most common attacks that your organisations face? When you look at your firewall experiences every month, that'll certainly give you insights into what needs to be done to protect the enterprise. Do you have sufficient resources to deal with those cyber risks? The detect function. This deals really whether you have the people, processes and competencies in place to detect a breach. What's the time delay between a breach occurring and the breach being detected? There's a growing list of controls that help examine the computer network and traffic to see if there's any anomalies. If there is someone in your enterprise whose job it is to analyse network logs or firewalls on a regular basis to check for any irregularities, how can you possibly work that out, whether you've got regular behaviour on your network systems or incongruous behaviour, unless you dedicate the right resources to actually examine these logs? The respond function deals with how you respond once the intrusion is detected in the most effective and efficient manner. So how would you respond if someone does detect a breach or a potential breach? How would you notify law enforcement agencies or your customers of a breach of their personal data? Do you have an internal rapid response group or a CERT? And does it contain people from the various parts of the technology stack, including those involved with your networking, firewall, servers, backup? Most importantly, do you have business stakeholders involved? Because to have a true CERT, You can't be appropriate without representation from the business because they're the business owners and they're the ones that make the calls. Do you conduct rehearsals with your cert? This actually enables crystallisation about your thinking about how best to respond to incidents. A common use in role plays is a thing called playbooks, where you actually document the potential incident and the proposed response. The only downside to those, of course, is in all likelihood the next attack will probably be totally different from the one that you've obviously rehearsed with. The recover function deals with business continuity plans, which maintains resilience and recover capabilities after a breach. So the important thing here is, do you conduct crisis rehearsals at senior management level that are not related to IT? Have you ever conducted a cyber attack crisis rehearsal by the same group? Ideally, I would suggest that the enterprise needs to conduct top management crisis rehearsals every 9 months and additional specific IT rehearsals every 18 months. Okay, so now we've considered briefly the NIST cybersecurity framework, we're now going to consider the function of risk transfer. Cyber insurance is just one piece of the puzzle to achieve a holistic security plan. Cyber insurers may require the implementation of basic cybersecurity measures to avert voiding coverage. The mere process of applying for cyber insurance can encourage companies to identify past breaches and tools, perform advanced reviews, and improve communication amongst the various stakeholders, such as legal, IT, finance, and risk management teams. Residual benefits can include a higher chance of repelling an adversary and lower premiums, the promise of which may encourage organisations to get serious about their defences beyond the bare minimum. Now, for some businesses, cyber insurance policies will be the only way the organisation will cover in the event of a breach and protect them against a protracted interruption to their business. The benefits offered with standalone cyber insurance will be much cheaper alternative for accessing the specialist services during or post-breach than paying for remediation outright after the fact. No level of insurance will cover the hit on the organisation's reputation and the brand damage associated with a breach. The most serious loss afterwards is that of trust. People will actually think twice about doing business with a company that's been hacked. So you'll see here business and residual risk. These are the areas that are not risk transferable, and these are the things that I will now show you actually cost the most amount of money to organisations. So what we've done here, we've put up a chart showing some very high-profile successful cyber attacks on some American large corporations. And you'll see the impact of the data breaches, the amount of customer data records that have been lost through the breach. And you can see basically the total payouts by the company where we know what they are, and then you can see the insurance payouts. And what will become very apparent, and I'll perhaps just say a few words around the Anthem Health data breach. The actual costs they incurred for legal and consultant fees alone in Anthem, even though it says it's not known, is $230 million. They only had $100 million of insurance coverage to help cover that. And with 80 million records, even if you assume that it's going to cost them $50 US per record to remediate, you're probably looking at something like $3.9 billion in loss. So you can see that they can be rather large. So what I'm really showing you here is just illustrating your point about cyber resilience it being more important than insurance, which really plays a secondary role. Okay. Right, cyber insurance in Australia. Still in its infancy, it's got premiums around about $25 million Australian dollars. Consider what the global cyber premium pool is estimated to be in 2020, which is $7 billion US dollars. Currently, there are about 16 cyber product offerings in Australia, but there's not a standard product. You can get capacity up to $200 million in the local market. Now, standalone cyber insurance, which is both first and third party, so I've coloured them in for you so you can see. First and third party, and of course you've got the cyber security event response costs there. Basically, is intended to cover gaps in traditional insurance coverage as well as covering new risks, which are, of course, emerging in the digital age. Traditional policies that do not have cyber exclusions will be exposed to cyber-related claims. However, the outcomes are going to be dependent on the policy language and, of course, the basis on which the claims are framed, and no doubt will potentially end up in litigated disputes. There are still overlaps between cyber insurance cover and more traditional products, for example, media liability, crime and management liability. Effective crisis management is perhaps the critical part for cyber products, as in most cases the expedient and correct handling of the media and customers after a cyber event is crucial to controlling other first-party costs, which is particular business interruption, and to limit the potential for third-party liabilities. Here's the key point. Having an external collaborating panel of competent third-party cyber event response providers is more essential than the cover itself. And this is because the main cost drivers of Australia for typical cyber losses comprise 32% for forensic and investigation costs, 11% for outbound contact and credit card monitoring, 9% for legal services, and 20% for business interruption. All presentations are always open to a free plug, so I'm just quickly, Munich Re, recognising the different needs of both business for risk transfer, for cyber insurance, and for insurers to manage their accumulation of losses within acceptable limits and to be able to better price the product. We've developed a modular cyber wording so the organisation can select what cover it needs, with different sections being individually written and priced. So pricing of cyber risk is really problematic at present, simply because of the scarcity of the data. Whilst there are markets for the assessment regarding loss frequencies due to the different cyber-related threats, this is clearly not the case for loss severities. To turn knowledge about threats into the ability to quantify loss potential, historical threats and losses have to be matched systematically. As of today, this kind of data is not available, and unfortunately, it is not an option to buy external pricing models either. So these are the reasons that give motivation for what we call the database project. So globally, there is a cyber exposure data schema initiative to collect data across the US and the UK, cyber markets, which is structured into six categories, which are cyber peril codes, geographic jurisdiction, cyber loss coverage categories, business sector, enterprise attributes, and cyber risk attributes. The objective, of course, is to allow modelling of a cyber risk tool and a risk management tool development. Now, I'm just going to talk very quickly about risks of change, because this clearly affects the ability to look at future cyber losses. And the key considerations we're needing to take into account here is emerging information technology, which produces new software vulnerabilities and new non-quantifiable cyber losses, the increased interconnectedness, particularly Internet of Things, which will impact the accumulation of losses from one cyber attack. I think recently there was a CCTV botnet, which was then impacted and affected 25,000 CCTV devices around the world, which will give you an idea of an accumulation-style loss. Reactive changes in the legislation and regulations, which impacts the future cost of claims. So, for example, here in Australia, the big one, of course, is the upcoming expected release of mandatory data breach reporting, which, according to the latest things I read, could be by the end of the spring session in Parliament. And what effect will that have? Well, actually, it's going to quadruple the current costs of cyber claims in Australia, because now we're going to have to develop and look at notification costs and compensation from the liability losses that will follow from privacy breaches. And, of course, in economic hard times, IT budgets get haircuts, the risk management controls internally generally don't work as well, and of course the internal threats then result in bad employee behaviours, and of course we can expect increases from internal threats to result in other cyber losses. So there's some of the things around risk of change that are worth talking about. So let's get on to some modelling frameworks and data before I finish. So there are a number of threat modelling frameworks which are designed to help organisations understand cybersecurity risks in a formal and structured way. Each has a specific focus, and you can see that from the illustration of the different frameworks that I've got there. Now, according to the US SANS Institute study on tools and standards for cyber threat intelligence, if organisations want to share incident data and be part of the analysis of a broad data set, then the Verisk framework would be the best choice. And so I'm going to give you a little bit of a spiel about Verisk. The Verisk framework is a standard way for defining security incidents in a structured, repeatable manner and sharing incident information where other organisations can contribute data in a standard format and vocabulary. The data can then be incorporated and used as a larger data set for analysing and reporting, such as the Verizon Data Breach Investigation Report. The overall goal is to lay a foundation on which we can constructively and cooperatively learn from our experiences to better manage risk. The Verisk schema includes five sections: incident tracking, victim demographics, incident disruption, discovery and response, and impact assessment. Just try and remember those. You'll see why in a moment. Each of these sections has multiple elements with specific data types and variables. Some elements, for example, hacking variety, has no fewer than 46 different hacking varieties. Verisk is capable of storing data in a format that can be automatically shared, which supports requirements R-squared. It is designed for strategic information and provides an aggregate view of all incidents. So this brings me to why we're going to have to shake up what we do in reporting cyber threats and losses in Australia. Let's just have a quick look at the APRA National Claims and Policy Database. The local insurance industry has made a decision to offer cyber insurance as part of the professional indemnity financial lines portfolio. As such, we're going to expect insurers to submit policy and claims data based on the existing requirements of the NCPD for this line of business. So let's just have a look at some of the extracts here. Types of professional risks, types of occupations, and types of cause loss codes. So the extracts displayed show that the occupation codes do not even align with the NAIC codes, which are used more universally in global cyber markets. Similarly, the general nature of loss and claim type categories have little, if any, relationship with cyber threats and loss types. So there have been some preliminary discussions between the ICA, or Insurance Council Australia, and APRA regarding future requirements for reporting of policy and claims data for cyber insurance. As you can imagine, to change the current basis of reporting is going to mean huge IT changes at a considerable cost, and I'd imagine there'll be big pushback. Nonetheless, I thought I'd at least introduce you to what should be happening, as it is happening in other markets like the US and the UK. One of the requirements will be the need for a catastrophe code for cyber accumulation losses, or sometimes we refer to these as a cyber tsunami. Although there are several catastrophe scenarios on a global basis that are currently being modelled, in Australia, three types that are likely to be relevant are a self-producing computer virus where a large number of systems are infected by one event, giving rise to first-party business interruption and data recovery costs; a malicious attack against a large cloud service provider, which will result in a multi-insured data breach with large number of impacted cloud clients impacted from the one event, giving rise to data breach and liability claims. And the last one is critical infrastructure attack, possibly a terrorist attack on energy resulting in power outage, telecommunications, the outage of the internet, information technology, being corrupted software scenario, which gives rise to physical damage, business services, business interruption, and bodily injury. Well, look, I'd like to thank you for listening. I know it's a lot to digest. I am open to take questions, and I just want to draw your attention to the presentation. It does have an appendix because I know you're from the accounting actuarial world. So what I've done, I've actually included a lot of information around your industry. So there's plenty of nice stats in there for you to just see where the cyber threats are, particularly and peculiar to your industry. So by all means, when you get away, feel free to have a look at those at your own leisure. Open to questions.
I had two. Like, the first one was, you mentioned frequency in pricing is somewhat predictable compared to severity. Could you elaborate on that?
Yes, sorry. So what I did say was that there's an enormous number of external companies that are providing a lot of data around frequency of cyber threats that actually occur. The problem is that we don't get the same data about the loss severity that happened from those cyber losses that happened from the cyber threats. So I think that's the point you were making. I'm sorry if you misunderstood what I said.
And you meant, obviously, this one's covering reinsurers' view.
Yes.
I mean, how do you separate insurance and reinsurance for cyber? I mean, from a product perspective and structuring perspective.
Yeah, okay, so I think from a reinsurance point of view, our largest concern is around the accumulation losses or the cyber tsunami scenarios, because clearly when you're participating on an insurance company base who issue policies to thousands of different customers, the one event can trigger all those policies and then basically cause what we call an accumulation type of event. So from the reinsurance perspective, what we do is we have, funny enough, an aggregate event limit that we place on the reinsurance, which basically says, hey, if all this goes to the wall and there is a massive cyber tsunami event, the maximum we'll pay in any annual given period is this total amount of dollars, and that is it under the reinsurance contract. So we have to protect ourselves as well for exactly doing that. Insurers, the best way they can protect themselves when they issue cyber policies is to have sublimits, which are applicable to the different first and third party coverages, and an aggregate annual limit. That's the best way they can try and control the accumulation effect on the insurer's own net retention.
And also the Australian market, could you elaborate a bit on that? Like, the, you said it's in infancy at the moment.
It is. So basically what's happened is that, as you'd expect, the US market, which is a more developed market, has been going for 10 years. The US market, it's probably got premiums now in the range of $2 to $3 billion in cyber premiums. What the US carriers that are locally represented here, likes of Chubb, AIG, Liberty International Underwriters, Zurich, what they've done is simply transported products that they use in the US market and have transported them, dumped them here in Australia. My personal view is that, as they're now finding out, well, actually, those products are probably not totally appropriate for our needs here in Australia, and they're finding that out now. Of course, a number of those companies are already doing policy revisions to take that on board. Other organisations like underwriting agencies from Lloyd's, there are a couple of other underwriting agencies like Hollard Insurance with Emergents, clearly provide it, and so we now have in total about 16 only insurers, including Lloyd's underwriting agencies, in our market at this point in time. Some of the biggest insurers like Suncorp and QBE really are not into the cyber market in any big way at this point in time. It's a massive effort for these insurers to decide to make cyber insurance available to customers. Yep.
Just a slightly different question. Sure. So I'm quite new to this industry. Just a question on, you were saying that the new legislation is going to quadruple the costs of any incident. Can you just explain that to me a bit further?
Yep, sure. So basically the costs at the moment that we're seeing from cyber claims in Australia at the moment are really around the cyber response expense costs when a breach actually occurs. And so most of the costs are involved in forensics and credit card monitoring, a little bit of legal costs, and, of course, business interruption to the business. What we're not seeing is any third-party liability claims, believe it or not. And part of the reason for this is that because there's no mandatory data breach reporting legislation, which, when it comes into place in any event, will only apply to, as I understand, organisations with revenues above $2 million, which means most companies at the moment are not reporting data breaches, and are probably making their first point of call to their own legal team, who naturally enough are not going to suggest that they disclose to the public that they've had a breach of customers' data. So basically the liability claims are not following breaches where privacy records basically are exposed. So when mandatory data breach reporting does come in and it's then mandatory reported to the OIC, which is the regulator, then basically we're going to expect the notification costs and the compensatory damages, where obviously liabilities arise from those breaches, we're going to expect the current claims value to quadruple. And that's simply based on the fact of what we see in the US and UK markets, particularly where there's class action availability, and as there is here in Australia. Yeah.
Thank you.
Do you have any good news for us?
I think the real key to this whole the whole subject is really around cyber resilience, and I think insurance does play a very important but secondary role in the sort of the total holistic approach to cyber security. And I can only emphasise that all organisations really need to take this seriously. It's not the role of an IT department. It's really an enterprise risk management problem.
Mark, so you said that there's a lot of data around frequency and
yep.
there's not very much on severity. Can you sort of give us a flavour of what kind of severity modelling framework you would recommend for insurers and reinsurers in the absence of data? And then second question is, you mentioned ransomware. I'd be interested to understand from personal experience or otherwise what kind of amounts we're talking about to unlock a phone and all these things.
Okay, so the problem with quoting statistics is, and this is to your last part of your question, the problem with quoting statistics is that no sooner than I will quote a statistic from a particular report, the next day someone will come out with a statistic that will be on the same topic and it will be a different number. So, look, all I can say is that I get a lot of my statistics out of Advisen, Semantic, Verizon, Phenomenon, all of these reports, they pump out statistics all the time, and it's probably not appropriate that I give you any meaningful statistics. I think it was mentioned earlier that the Australian government produced some reports here. Australian government's just released their 2016 cyber threat report that has some statistics in it. ASIC in their report 429, which I referred to in my presentation, has some statistics in here as well, and they also give you, both of these publications give you a really good description of the types of cyber threats and the types of losses that are coming from ransomware in the Australian context, which I think is probably relevant for what you're saying. In terms of what insurers need to do, what I said in my presentation is really real. Until the industry gets serious about recording cyber information in a prescribed framework like the Verisk standard, we're never really going to get good data so that we can do proper actuarial pricing modelling and really understand just what the cyber actuarial numbers look like in terms of being able to price and even quantify the type of product we're dealing with. So that's really a problem that we've got to address.
So if no further questions, I'd like to thank you all for coming today for the cyber risk session. I hope you've all gained further insight into the risk management process for it and the Australian market compared to overseas. And please join me in thanking Mark again for his time.